Well, it has been less than 30 days since the presidential election, and serious events are happening that relate to end-time prophecy, have you noticed? In the United States, we are looking at going over the financial cliff, as it's called. And most Americans are not really concerned, nor do they think it will impact them in any way. I say most. There are many who are concerned, of course. Two-thirds of our nation is facing devastating drought, and very few Americans have heard about it or even care. I have an article I'm going to come to here later. It's showing the map of the United States and how that two-thirds of the U.S., you can look at it afterwards here if you want to come up and see it, because you won't be able to see it from up here. But I looked at that, and that's why I cut it out of the paper. It's from the USA Today, and that's incredible. Now, I relate to it because my wife's family is from Kansas, and that's every time she talks to her mother every day, and that one of the big problems is the drought in Kansas. Well, it's not just in Kansas. It's all over, and I don't think we really understand how huge this is. The majority of Americans, by their attitudes and their votes, indicate that they want a welfare state, want everything provided. Well, that's going to lead to economic destruction, but the majority do not seem to care or understand or realize how it will. You cannot continue to spend what you do not have. You know that individually and as a nation. You will see some statistics I'm going to give you here as we go through this a little bit later of just how huge our debt really is. It is not $16 trillion. It is much, much higher than that, and people do not realize it. Governments play with figures, and they are able to leave certain figures out. We'll come to that later. Around the world, for example, Israel finds itself facing more serious threats from the Muslim world of Iran, Egypt, Hezbollah in Lebanon, a Palestinian non-member observer state now that we seem to have here in the United Nations, and also, of course, Hamas in Gaza. President Morsi of Egypt, of the Muslim Brotherhood Party, has given himself dictatorial powers over Egypt. Anything significant about that? Well, we'll look and see. Well, we could go on, but let's ask the question, what is going on? And what does it all mean? That's what's important. Well, this morning, let's look at current events and end-time prophecies, because things seem to be speeding up and marching right along. I want to begin by going to Jesus' Olivet Prophecy. Anytime you get into the subject of prophecy and current events, the main prophecy where you would want to start, I would think, would be in Matthew 24, the Olivet Prophecy. What's interesting about this prophecy in verse 3, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" We want to know. What can we look for is what they're asking. What is it that we should go through and be expecting to see? Well, there are many things that he laid out here in the 24th chapter, and it's got a dualism in it, by the way. Some of it certainly was fulfilled by 70 A.D. In the Middle East there. I want to say Palestine, but they didn't go by that. Judea, as it was. But the majority of it has yet to happen. Well, I'm not going to get into all the individual things about it, but I do want to go, well, let's look at a couple things here. What does it all eventually lead to? Well, in verse 21, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." And so who are the elect? The part of the ecclesia, the church. "For their sake, he will not allow man to go into extinction." Because it will come to that point. In fact, as I've told people at times when I've gone over this with them, I said, look, God is allowing man to do it his way all the way up to the point that if he waits another day, there'll be nothing to come back to. And really, that's what it's indicating here. And Jesus Christ will come back to stop man from annihilating himself and he will take charge. And for 1,000 years, things will be run through his government out of Jerusalem. And man, who has always wanted peace, but on his terms and his ways, will find he will have peace, but it will be on God's terms. And it will be a different world. And it will be indeed something incredible for people to live into. And what's really going to be great is Satan and the demons, who are the gods of this world, as used that term in 2 Corinthians 4:4, will be put away. And that spirit won't be here to have an influence on human beings. And they don't realize where that influence is coming from. Now let's drop down to verse 36 of the Olivet Prophecy. But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. And in Mark's account, in Mark 13, is it in verse 32, it says even the Son of Man, that Jesus Christ, doesn't know that day, but only the Father. Now, verse 37, but as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, I look around and I kind of wonder, not only in our nation, but in all nations around the world, that people do not seem, are totally unaware of what's taking place and what's happening, and just living for the moment. When you see the riots in Greece and Athens, when you see them also in places such as in Spain and Madrid, over having all of the things being cut back because the other European countries do not have the money just to continue to give to them so they can pay for their welfare states. They are bankrupt, is what it amounts to. I don't care. I want my check. I mean, you see that if you watch the news and see what they're throwing things at the police and who have these things up here protecting themselves and all of that. Nobody wants to do what take the steps that it will take in order to correct the problem, do they? Everybody just going about their own business, like it said here in the days of Noah. They didn't know what was going on in the days of Noah. Hey, we have this guy over here building this big boat. You know, it's great to come out and take a look at that. He said it's going to flood here one of these days. Now, do any of you really believe that? You know, that attitude then, I think we see as an attitude throughout for human beings today, just as in the days of Noah. It is a very, very sad thing. I've been watching things on the news, people interviewed here. They had this race down here, the last one of the NASCAR season, and I didn't go to watch the race or anything, but several days later on the news, they were down there interviewing some of the people, asking them about what's going on and what they thought. They asked the opinion of what's your opinion about the situation that took place in Benghazi? What's that? Yeah, I'm just here to enjoy this great race and everything. I don't know about Benghazi. Well, we had our ambassador killed. And three others, including former Navy SEALs, in trying to save his life. And nobody went there to help him. And you don't even know about it? You never heard about it, right? It was interesting. Then they ask other people other questions that you would have thought they would have heard about or known. Oh, it really doesn't matter. It's all going to straighten itself out. It's all going to work. You know, this attitude behind it. I really don't want to be bothered, but I think it's going to. We're really doing great. We're coming back now. Well, that attitude, I would submit to you, was what took place in the days of Noah. And people are blind to what's happening. And not until the waters begin to come and the rains begin to come do they begin to realize. And it's too late. And I'm afraid that's what we're going to see in our country today, and not just in our country, but in many countries, especially of the Western world. Europe certainly is going to experience that. And the time is coming. Time is running out. And but people think it's just going to always go on. Well, hasn't it always? Well, no. See, that 120 years in building that ark, well, that's a long time in human experience. I mean, he started this thing back here 75 years ago. Nothing's happened yet. He's almost got it done. No. And when we look at things today, you see the same attitude that's going on. Now, I want to focus on that just for a little bit, because even in the Church of God, people who you would think in the Church of God, as all the years we've talked about how Jesus warns us to watch prophecy. I'm going to read the verse in just a moment here, that we are to watch these things, because the apostles said, tell us. They wanted to watch. They wanted to know. I had one person in the church tell me here recently, oh, I don't need to watch all the news and what's going on. All I do is drive up and down I-95, and that's all I need to know. I about, what? I didn't know what to say. I was so shocked that somebody would say that to me, and a member of the church. And, well, I hope that none of you feel that way. But sometimes I wonder, do we sleep? We are Americans in America, and America is asleep. And do we as Americans, even though we are in the Church of God, do we sleep too? We have to ask ourselves that. We need to really be watching these things, what's going on here. All right, let me go on here to verse, drop down to verse 42. Watch, therefore, Jesus said, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. At an hour that you do not expect. And, of course, the flood in Noah's day came at an hour that the people around Noah did not expect, did they? All right. Well, the world certainly does not pay attention, and sometimes even in the Church of God, people are not paying attention as they should. There is a scripture, before I move on, I won't turn to this scripture, but I'll certainly quote it. It's 2 Peter 3 and in verse 18, where Peter ends that second letter by saying that we must grow in grace and knowledge. Grow in grace and knowledge. Well, why? Well, so that we will not be deceived. And we will see these things if we are truly growing in grace and knowledge. If we're reading the Bible, if we're staying close to God, if we're watching as Jesus instructed us to do, then we won't be caught unawares. And things are beginning to move along. Now I'd like to go to Daniel, the 11th chapter. Daniel, the 11th chapter. And at the end of the chapter, in verse 40... Actually, I covered this in August, but I want to cover it again, as you will see in just a moment why. this is something that I think is very important in watching what's going on around the world. Now, first of all, let me read it here. Daniel chapter 11 and in verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships, and he shall enter the countries and overwhelm them and pass through. Now, if you read the prior verses here, particularly in verses 5 through 28 of the 11th chapter, you see that the king of the south, anciently, was Egypt. And the king of the north, which started out to be the Seleucid Empire following the death of Alexander the Great, but then later was conquered and taken over by the Romans. And the king of the north really became that which came out of Rome. But I would like to focus on what it says here concerning the king of the south, and especially when you understand what country we're talking about here. Some have speculated, because they never saw too much for years and years, well, maybe the king of the south, knowing this prophecy, maybe it's some other part. Maybe it is the Muslim extremism going on. Maybe that's what's going to be the king of the south. Some have even thought, well, maybe it's Iran. But, you know, I don't see anything about Iran or Persia, as it would be in the Bible, in these verses. Nowhere. But I do about Egypt. And, of course, I want to bring it up because of what happened here in this last week, where President Morsi took on the dictatorial powers that it's no longer really a democracy. And he made the statement, God's will and elections made me the captain of this ship. Really? Where will God's will tell him to go? Now think about that. We should always be aware of those who think they have divine guidance in an office like this. Well, here in the verse it says that the king of the south, and it's in the time of the end, is going to attack the king of the north. But the king of the north is going to counterattack and overrun not only him, but as you read 41, 2, and 3, North Africa and all the way to the state of Israel are all listed there, aren't they? So what could possibly, when you look and you say, I use this book, and I'll read just, if you'll bear with me, another paragraph from it. The book, The Fight for Jerusalem by Dory Gold, former UN ambassador from Israel. I can tell you the Israelis, I don't believe, are asleep. Not after this, the threats that go on. They know. And what's happening. It's interesting when you read what Dory Gold here wrote just a couple years ago, and it's very true. It's coming to bear more and more as time goes by. Let me just read a couple little short paragraphs here. Jihadist apocalyptic references appear in various guises, though most relate to prophecies about a major confrontation with the West. This theme does not originate in the Quran, but rather in Islamic oral traditions known as Hadith, H-A-D-I-T-H. One does not have to look hard to find allusions to this apocalyptic battle in jihadist proclamations. For example, Sheikh Yusuf al-Kahari, whatever, I know I'm massacring the name, it's hard to pronounce. Anyhow, the spiritual head of the Muslim Brotherhood refers to, quote, the signs of the victory of Islam, including its impending conquest of Europe. He relates prophecies that both Istanbul and Rome will be conquered, postulates that the fall of Rome is near, and follows this with a discussion of the global dissemination of Islam. Abu Qatada, a jihadist cleric who served as bin Laden's representative in Britain, took this scenario one step further, explaining the symbolic importance of conquering Rome for Islam's ultimate apocalyptic battle. Quote, Rome is a cross, the West is a cross, and Romans are the owners of the cross. The Muslims, end of quote, the Muslims must target the West. Abu Qatada explains, adding, quote, those who will destroy Rome are already preparing the swords, and Rome will not be conquered with the word, but with the force of arms. I could go on, but I think that's enough. You begin to see, and I've read this to you before. Now, it really came to light when President Morsi suddenly declared that that God has shown him that he is to be the sole ruler, and any legislation is above being considered in the courts or by the legislature in any way to be struck down. In other words, he has complete full power. Something to watch. For several years now, the Muslim Brotherhood has been one of the things that has always been in Egypt, I should say, in the background there to try to overthrow former President Mubarak. They attempted to assassinate him. They did assassinate Anwar Sadat. They failed in assassinating Mubarak. Mubarak took dictatorial powers to maintain his position, and frankly, you can understand why. Because of the attempts, and if he let down in any way, the Brotherhood would have tried to do him in, which they did. this is something here to be watching. How fast will this take place? Another thing to consider, in the Muslim world, when they have conquered something in the past and lost it, they feel they have a right to it in the future. And of course, the 1,000 years ago, the Muslims from North Africa entered through Spain into Europe, and until I believe it was Charles Martel stopped them at the Battle of Tours. And they also later, during the time of the Habsburg dynasty in Austria, entered Europe from the southeast, which is why today some of the little states over there are all Muslim. Albania and, Yugoslavia was broken up, and I don't remember which ones became Christian or call themselves Christian and the others call themselves Muslim. But several of them in there. And the reason why then is because they were dominated by the Muslims at the time of the 15th, 16th century. And, of course, they made people Muslims, either that or they died. And so they chose the former to be converted to Islam. This is something really to keep our eyes on, what will transpire in Egypt. You do not read, as I mentioned here, anything about Iran. Or Persia, as it would be called in the Bible. But you certainly do read about Egypt. As you read on in verses 41, and he shall enter in the king of the north, he shall also enter the glorious land, Israel, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon, which we believe most likely would be what we would generally call the Palestinian Arabs, the Jordanians, in that group of people at that time. We don't see any specific other nation that would, except Moab and Ammon, of course, because in Jordan, Ammon is its capital. Verse 42, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So you have these people in verse 41 that seem to be able to, coexist, get along, but why? What about Egypt? Egypt doesn't fare too well here when the king of the north comes back. Well, it indicates that the king of the south must have been from Egypt. And the king of the north is not going to, Egypt's not going to get off very well when he retaliates. Verse 43, he shall have power over the treasures of gold, silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, also the Libyans, Ethiopians that shall follow at his heels. North Africa, all the way down the African side of the Red Sea to Ethiopia. So that area will be completely conquered by the Europeans. Now, one other thing one has to ask. How long after some kind of an attack takes place on Europe from the king of the south before the king of the north can retaliate and be able to do this immediately? May not be able to. Is there a king of the north? Well, I don't know who it is at this time. It's interesting, though, that the Muslim Brotherhood, they talk about attacking Rome, not Jerusalem or Israel, although they back up Hamas in Gaza. They stood behind them in the sense of trying to broker a peace or whatever. But throughout that book that I just had, you don't see, in fact, the quote that a number of them have said that Dory Gold quoted here from that was appeared on Al Jazeera TV was that the route to Jerusalem is through Cairo. First of all, we must take Cairo. And then what's next? Not necessarily Jerusalem. Have you noticed here, when you look at verse 40, the king of the south. Now, if the king of the south is Egypt, as historically the king of the south was, and is the king of the south in the end times, why would he attack the king of the north rather than the Jewish people that are next door? The king of the south does not attack Judah. Nothing is said about it. The only thing said about it is when the king of the north comes back over North Africa, overrunning Egypt, and then he does what? He takes the glorious land. Interesting. You know, all of the Europeans in this vote the other day to make the Palestinians a observer state was on the anniversary of when in, what was the, 1947, wasn't it? Yes, 1947. It was on that date in 1947 that the United Nations had voted for there to be both a Palestinian and a Jewish or Israeli state. and the Palestinians would not accept it at that time unless it was they had it all. That's been the case ever since. And so for 65 years, there could have been two states. One side was willing, the other side was not. We get it all, and we want you out in the ocean or out there in the Mediterranean. We push you out. We don't want you here at all. Well, who had it before either one of you were here? The Turks. 400 years, the Turks had it. So how can you say it's yours and yours only? We didn't see you fighting the Turks. You didn't seem to be upset about the Turks even being there. And they controlled everything for 400 years. Well, coming back now. So when we look at Daniel chapter 11, there's a number of things here. What's interesting to me, how is Israel, the modern state of Israel, left out of verse 40? When you would think that it would be a lot easier to attack the state of Israel than it would be to take some wild shot at Europe. But when you read the thinking of the mind of the extremists in the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, and they actually want to attack Rome because they consider Catholicism to be competitive to them, and so attack Rome. Well, that's certainly where the ancient king of the north was, wasn't it? Anciently, historically. So we need to really be watching the events that might take place here. And I don't know, because when you have somebody who thinks that he has divine guidance and that God is the one that put him there, you don't know what they might do. Now, I believe that they are they're getting guidance, but I don't agree that it's the same source that you and I would think of, the God of this world, as Paul said. Is the one who gives guidance. You think Adolf Hitler didn't get some guidance? You go through history and you read a little bit about some of the guidance these individuals have had and how they sought that guidance. And Napoleon, you know why he went into the Great Pyramid in Egypt, in Giza? And by himself. And he came out because he was told what he would do. Yes, he went there, and he specifically did not enter that thing with his entourage around him. He entered it by himself. Well, anyhow, let's get back to this and move forward. Well, meanwhile, as this prophecy in Daniel is beginning to take shape, as we're beginning to see something here, and we'll just have to watch it and see how it plays out over there in Egypt. And will this man turn out to be the king of the south? Will the Brotherhood and this individual do something rather, insane, in fact? We'll see. But as that's going on, what is happening in the United States, the most powerful nation on earth? Remember Hal Lindsey in his book, I quoted here a couple, his book came out a couple years ago after 9/11. And he had a section in which he said, I've studied prophecy in the Bible for 40 years. And I cannot understand how the greatest superpower that's ever existed, and it's at the time of the end, is not mentioned in the Bible. Well, it is. He just doesn't know where the people of the Western world have descended from. Well, anyhow, coming back, so what about the United States? Yes, it is a nation that God recognizes in the sense that of its importance. How did we get that wealth? Did we just do it ourselves? I can agree with President Obama when he said, in one sense, that you didn't build that. That's right. We did have. Neither one understands who was truly behind this country becoming great as it is. God, in fulfilling ancient prophecies and promises, allowed for this country to become as great as it is. And in that sense, you could say, yes, that's true. We didn't do that ourselves. It is something that God is the one who is able to give the wealth or provide the means to learn how to have wealth and to build into a great nation. All right, let me take a look now at the United States. We see things happening in Egypt and the Middle East. Well, what about here? Well, our welfare state debt is really not $16 trillion, I told you in the introduction. It is $86.8 trillion. Now, how did we come up with a figure like that? Well, let me tell you, right out of the Wall Street Journal here. Get it up where I can read it, see it. Print is small here. As Washington wrestles with the roughly $600 billion fiscal cliff and the 2013 budget, the far greater fiscal challenge of the U.S. government's unfunded pension and health care liabilities remains offstage. The truly important figures would appear on the federal balance sheet if the government prepared an accurate one. But it hasn't. For years, the government has gotten by without having to produce the kind of financial statements that are required of most significant for-profit and non-profit enterprises. The U.S. Treasury balance sheet does list liabilities such as Treasury debt issued to the public, federal employee pensions, and post-retirement health benefits. But it does not include the unfunded liabilities of Medicare, Social Security, and other outsized and very real obligations. The actual liabilities of the federal government, including Social Security, Medicare, and federal employees' future retirement benefits, already exceeds $86.6 trillion, or 550% of the GDP, gross domestic product. For the year ending December 31, 2011, the annual accrued expense of Medicare and Social Security was $7 trillion. Nothing like that figure is used in calculating the deficit. In reality, the reported budget deficit is less than one-fifth of the more accurate figure. Why haven't Americans heard about the titanic $86.8 trillion liability from these programs? One reason: the actual figures do not appear in black and white on any balance sheet. But it is possible to discover them. Included in the annual Medicare Trustees Report are separate actuary estimates of the unfunded liability for Medicare Part A, the hospital portion, Part B, medical insurance, and Part D, prescription drug coverage. As of the most recent trustees report in April, the net present value of the unfunded liability of Medicare was $42.8 trillion, not billion, trillion. The comparable balance sheet liability for Social Security is $20.5 trillion. Of course, what you heard was that we just went over the brink before the election. When was it? August, September, and went to 16. Now, those are figures that are not including the Medicare and Social Security. And it's kind of like the unemployment rate. I mean, it's not 8%. It is much higher. And if you leave out everybody who has finally given up on looking for work because it's been so many months and almost years since they could find work, then suddenly, in many cases, you go up between 12 and 15%. All right. So what's going on here? Here we're looking at debt. How was it that Adolf Hitler was able to rise out of in the early 30s? Because Germany was absolutely broke, and people were in misery, and they had nothing. You probably have seen pictures, old newsreels, of the wheelbarrow loads of Deutschmarks somebody is wheeling around. Worthless, worthless. And from that, a lot of times, somebody rises who's going to save the day, but really does not save the day at all, and should not be the one that should be there in the first place. What else is going on here? We have this incredible debt, far more than people realize. By the way, that's Wall Street Journal on November 27th. What was that, Wednesday, I think? Tuesday or Wednesday, whichever day that was. Now I want to also mention in the introduction, what about the drought? Well, this is from USA Today last week. Devastating drought likely to linger, make winter bleaker. Well, sure will. The merciless drought that has scorched much of central USA this year shows no signs of letting up, according to the most recent forecast from the Climate Prediction Center. For a massive portion of the nation, in almost every state west of the Mississippi River, drought is forecast to continue throughout the next several months. Now, according to Wednesday's U.S. Drought Monitor, a weekly federal report that tracks drought across the nation, the percentage of the USA enduring drought conditions worsened slightly from the week before, from 58.8 to 60.1% of the entire country. That's quite a map, if you want to look at it here after when we get done. I mean, it looks like to me it's more than closer to two-thirds. Even with the devastation from Superstorm Sandy in the Northeast, it's the drought that could do the most damage to the U.S. economy. Sandy's damages of perhaps $50 billion will likely be overshadowed by the huge cost of the Great Drought of 2012. This drought is the worst since the drought of 1954. And it shows here a picture of the ground all cracked and everything. Remember the Dust Bowl of the 30s? Kind of wonder, was it a foretaste of the time of the end that was to come? A couple other things about this. In order for parts of Oklahoma and Arkansas to come out of their drought, they would need more than a foot of rain, according to the Climate Prediction Center. Nebraska and Wyoming are enduring their driest year on record, according to the National Climatic Data Center. NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, reported that a drought severity index for the primary hard red winter wheat area located mainly in Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Kansas last month reached its worst reading since the 1950s. These are things that we need to be aware of and watch in the news, because it really has something to say about what may be happening and soon to this country. What's it going to do to this country? What is that kind of debt going to do to this country? What's a drought like that? Now, I don't know how long it takes before finally the prices reach the supermarket. And of all the things that are growing out there in these areas of the country, it is, as I've told you before, you go out there during the wheat harvest. It is an incredible thing to stand there and look. It's just like looking across the ocean at all of this wheat. And it is the breadbasket not only of the country but also of the world. And then with the drought being so severe that now they have to shut down the Mississippi River traffic just south there of St. Louis. And, of course, that's where all the barges of that wheat that is sold to the world goes out through New Orleans. Well, we're going to feel it here and probably in this next 6 months or so. Let me move on here on some other things going on. How about what other conditions in this country? How about socially and morally? Well, more states have approved gay marriages, legalized marijuana for non-medical use. We're progressive, aren't we? Our president wants to redistribute the wealth, which is nothing more than socialism. It is appealing to those who think they will be receiving some of that wealth. Certainly it is. Always has been. And I'm afraid that's the majority today. You know, Satan has said, in other words, put this thought in people's minds, and he says that his egalitarian economics is more fair than God's system that gives the individual the liberty to prosper and grow through hard work. See, that's not fair. What's fair is that we redistribute everything to everybody. And as Winston Churchill said, we will all be equally poor. And so they voted him out at the end of World War II. But he is absolutely right. There are principles. Look, 2 and 2 still equals 4. And that is, you cannot violate certain laws of economics and think that you can get a great result, because you will not. I'd like to look at a few scriptures here that I think describe us as a nation today. In Hosea chapter 4, right after Daniel. Hosea chapter 4 and verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. What's the charge? There's no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. That's the problem today. Now, I know there are many churches out there and many people sincerely believe in God and follow him. But I'm looking at the majority population of this country. We have, 300 million people here? Somewhere a much greater number apparently do not care that much. We do not see, and I think it's very true, that we do not see truth and mercy or the knowledge of God in the land. And if you drop down there to verse 6 and 7, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, because you have rejected knowledge. What kind of knowledge? Spiritual knowledge. Because if you have the spiritual knowledge and contact with God as a people first, then you'll be able to see and understand some of these other things as far as the issues in your country and all of that, what is right and what is wrong. I also will reject you from being priest for me, he said to Israel, because you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. The more they increased, the more they sinned against me. Look at our country. The more we have increased, the more the nation has turned away from God and rejected God. I will change their glory into shame, he says. In other words, we didn't build that. You're right, if you understand. God says, I built it. I made it so you could have it. I giveth and I taketh away. And I think we're going to begin to see that. And a lot of it we're simply doing to ourselves because, as it says there in verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And with a lack of knowledge, we make poor decisions. Let's look at a few other scriptures. Deuteronomy 32. Ancient scriptures that are very relevant today. Deuteronomy 32. And verse 28 and 29. Here Moses is speaking before he would die. In verse 28, for they are a nation void of counsel, nor is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. People aren't considering the latter end of the decisions they make today. Living for today. And it's going to catch up sooner than people realize or believe. Another one let's take a look at in Isaiah chapter 5. Prophet Isaiah. Again, very relevant today. Isaiah chapter 5. And in verse 13. Goes along with what Hosea was saying. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Because why? They have no, what kind of knowledge? The implication there is if they would have had the right kind of knowledge, that wouldn't have ever happened. It would have never happened. They would have been able to make decisions that would have prevented those things from happening. And in Isaiah 27, we see it again. Isaiah 27. And verse 11. When its boughs are withered, they will be broken off. The women come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Therefore, he who made them will not have mercy on them, and he who formed them will show them no favor. If you read the whole thing, it's because he had shown them favor. He had done these things. And It is a people that has no understanding. Whose fault? God's or theirs? See, what are you saying? It's their fault. And one last one is in Jeremiah chapter 4. Jeremiah 4. Let's take a look at this. In Jeremiah, the 4th chapter, and in verse 22. For my people are foolish. They have not known me. They are silly children, and they have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. Again, you see the pattern here of these scriptures, and talking, of course, about ancient Israel and Judah, but it really applies to us today. It's very relevant to us today. We look around, all we have to do is turn on the news and watch and see some of or even the newspapers or whatever we go to, about our country, and unfortunately it's a very, very sad situation. Now I'd like to go to Psalm 83. Psalm 83, and move this forward a little bit. The conditions here, and I don't know if we're going to, as a people, we're not going to of ourselves turn it around unless we turn to God as a nation. Now many people are in their sincerity, I think, trying to, but not enough. Not enough. And it's obvious when you look at the way people, why they voted, the way they voted, when they're interviewed, their attitudes, it begins to speak and say an awful lot. Here in Psalm 83, in verses 1 through 8, this is a prophetic psalm, and it really goes down to the time of the end. He said, "Do not keep silent, O God, and do not hold your peace. Do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, 'Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.' For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you." Well, who is this? The tents of Edom, Ishmaelites, Moab, Hagarites, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, the inhabitants of Tyre, which would be in Lebanon today. Assyria also has joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. And the children of Lot would be the Ishmaelites. So I want to stop there at the end of verse 8. It's interesting when you look at this, when was this going to happen? Well, has it happened yet? No. Now, who are these nations? Most of them are just all amalgamated together today of peoples that once were, at one time when this was written, individual small little states, I guess. There's one large one there in verse 8, and that is Assyria. It's interesting. It's always intrigued me about this prophecy for the time of the end, because do you notice who's missing? Egypt. Egypt's not there. Now, why isn't Egypt listed? Now, you would think. See, they all have something in common here, even though they, they are fragmented peoples and everything together, but they are united by their ancient hatred of the descendants of Israel and Judah. Other prophecies I've read to you where it actually says that, because of your ancient hatred. And that God, in the end, when Jesus Christ returns, will punish them for that, for what they will do to those captives and how they will treat them. But we see that Egypt is missing, so that raises a question. Does this happen when the king of the north counterattacks the king of the south? Something to think about. I don't know. Something to consider. Because Egypt is not involved. They're not even so much as mentioned. But Assyria is. Now, who is Assyria? If you look in the Middle East today, the ancient capital of Assyria was Nineveh, which is northern Iraq near the city of Mosul. It's just a heap. What happened to the people? They had taken the northern 10 tribes of Israel captive and dispersed them north of Nineveh. And later when the Babylonians attacked and conquered the Assyrian Empire and Nineveh, guess what? The surviving Assyrians and the Israelites who had been dispersed north of Nineveh, what direction did they go? The only direction they could, north, to escape. And you can read much about them in the passes through the Caucasus Mountains that they used as generations went by, moving into Europe. Later on, some of those people received the name Celtic from the Greeks. That's a Greek word, by the way, spelled with a K, not a C. Not that all Celtic tribes were that, but at least those that were crossing over them, they called them that. They didn't call themselves that. We have always believed that many of the descendants of the Assyrians are in Central Europe today. And some may realize it, but the majority, of course, would not. But that is a group of people who were of the lineage of Shem after the flood. And that's also, I think, important to realize because they would be part of the Caucasians who came in through the Caucasus Mountains, which is where the name came from, and inhabit much of Central Europe, Austria, Germany, some of the parts of Eastern Europe, and so forth. And as the centuries have gone by, you know, a lot can happen in 700 years from the time that the Israelites went into captivity until the coming of Jesus Christ. We've only been around less than 250. Look how big we are. Less than 250 years, and look at the wars we fought, all the incredible losses of life, and still have a population after less than 250 years of 300 million plus. What would happen to nations? Nations will multiply enormously if there is no epidemics of disease, droughts, wars, and things to stop it. Certainly those people, and the Assyrian people as well, because Nineveh fell in 612 B.C., about 100 years after they had taken the northern nation of Israel captive and redispersed them north of Nineveh. Let me get back on track here, but it's something to think about. Will the king of the north be of Assyrian descent? Keep in mind, when you study the kingdoms mentioned by both Daniel and again in the book of Revelation, and the fourth kingdom being the Roman Empire, that it would be conquered, but it would rise up. It would have 10 resurrections, of which the latter 7 of those 10 were called 7 heads. And we have always looked at and understood very clearly, and we're not the only ones, others have too, that when the Pope put the crown on the head of Justinian in 554, that was the beginning of the first head. And then on Christmas Day in 800 AD, the second one was put on the head of Charlemagne. And then Otto the Great, 962. Then Charles V of the Habsburg. Then Napoleon. None of those individuals were Italians. Not a one. Not a one was an Italian. They were all of a different group of people. And yet they were crowned as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire and trying to bring Europe or whatever unity to the empire once again in their generation. So something to keep in mind, I would not expect the King of the North to be Italian because none of the resurrections and the final one that we look for, I think, will be like the others of a different nationality. Let me move on quickly. This is spoken of, if you go to, what time is it? I will go quickly. Jeremiah chapter 30. Jeremiah chapter 30. What are these things leading up to? We are, as a nation, asleep. A time that is going to come on the world such as never has been before will catch us napping. Just like in World War II at Pearl Harbor, we were asleep. That was small compared to what's going to come. Here in Jeremiah chapter 30, verses, let's go to verse 7. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. And it is the time of Jacob's trouble. Using the term Jacob means Israel and Judah. but he shall be saved out of it. Yes, he'll be saved out of it. It's a time such as never has been before, as Jesus said. The whole chapter is very interesting to read here. Because of your sins, verse 14 and 15, I am going to allow this to come upon you and your rejection of me. Now, what's, I think, most interesting, too, is the time setting of the chapter. Look at the last verse, 24. The fierce anger of the Lord will not return until he has done it and until he has performed the intents of his heart. God is behind everything that is written in that chapter. In the latter days, you will consider it. So Jeremiah was inspired. He dated it, the latter days, the time of the coming of the Messiah. let me just skip on down. I could go to Isaiah chapter 11, verse 10 and 12, where it talks about Jesus Christ, when he returns, will bring Israel and Judah back a second time from national captivity. A second time. We all know of a first, but we can't point to a second. To save time, I won't turn over there. Now let's take a look, what about the ecclesia? Except for the ecclesia, except for the elect, those days would not be shortened, but they will be. Let's go to Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12. And verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation. Now this is what Jesus is saying in the Olivet Prophecy. Even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered. He's not just talking about the Jewish people as a nationality. He's talking about the spiritual Jews as they are, the church is referred to in the New Testament. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book of life. Of course, implying that those who are not in the book of life, it may not go so well. All right, how will God use Michael to deliver his people? Well, they're going to have to be serving and obeying God. If they're not, as we'll see, they're not going to be delivered. Let's go to Luke 21, Luke's account of the Olivet Prophecy. In Luke 21, in verse 34 through 36, but take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day comes on you unexpectedly. Now that's exactly the way it's going to come on this world. But he says, now to you, be sure that you do not let yourself fall into this stuff. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Well, the Christians are instructed, as we see here and as we saw in Matthew 24, to be watching and to be praying to stay close to God, and that we can be able to see these things. In Revelation chapter 3, there's a prophecy here to one of the churches. Revelation chapter 3, and in verse 10, he said this, because you have kept my command to persevere, I like the way the King James actually says it, you've kept the word of my patience. Going on, who say they are Jews, meaning spiritual Jews, and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them, I fell back on verse 9, I want to go to verse 10. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, or as others say, tribulation, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Because you have done this, because you are obeying, because you're staying close to me, I am going to protect you and preserve you from these things happening. Now, where will it be that he will do this? Where will it be? Will it be in heaven through a rapture? No, the Bible doesn't teach that. But here in Revelation chapter 12, let's see what the Bible does teach. The 12th chapter, Revelation 12, verses 14 through 17. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place. Symbolic language. Same language was used of Israel coming out of Egypt in Deuteronomy chapter 32. In other words, it means God's protection as the mother eagle takes her chicks out over the canyon to get away from the coyotes and so on. Those of you who've been out west. And this is what is being said here. But the woman, which is symbolic of a church, was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time, 3.5 years, from the presence of the serpent or Satan the devil. And so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. In chapter 17 of the same book, in verse 15, it says that the flood is symbolic of nations and armies. Okay. Now coming back, verse 16. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon, Satan the devil, was enraged with the woman, the church, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who apparently didn't follow the rest of them, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So apparently here in verse 17, some true Christians stay behind. And when Satan couldn't get those who left, he goes after those who are behind. And they may make up part of the martyrdom spoken of in the time of the Great Tribulation. There will be some martyrdoms that take place. Well, the place of deliverance, as we can see here, it goes into the wilderness. I don't know what wilderness. And some people have tried to say in the past, what about Petra over there in Jordan? Because it's mentioned in the book of Isaiah. Well, we do not dogmatically say that that's it. Maybe it is a place, someplace, but maybe there are other places too. You know, the Bible really doesn't identify the wilderness. And so we have to be careful, because some in the past have set their heart on God taking them to a place of safety in Petra. Well, you couldn't. That's a wilderness is what it is down there today. There's no way anybody would survive as it is. You certainly would need God's intervention. You better let God decide and show and make that plain when the time comes, and not decide or that we think we know in advance when we really do not. So the place of deliverance, though, is not going to be up in heaven as a rapture, as commonly and popularly taught today. It is on the earth. And Jesus is coming to the earth. And he is going to reign on the earth 1,000 years and forever. And, of course, a new heaven and a new earth will follow after that. Well, to summarize, I think that we can see that the church must continue to watch events that relate to end-time prophecy, as our Lord and Savior has instructed us to do. Events seem to be accelerating. We need to know what is going on and what it means for us in these end times.